Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Big hello to around the world, our listeners in New Zealand, Ireland, England, and all across North America. We have a great show tonight. Naturalist, author, Robert Michael Pyle will be joining us in just a little bit, and we'll have a chance to, I'm telling you, if you don't go anywhere, because this hour is going to be absolutely fantastic as we talk from butterflies to Bigfoot. It will be happening all here on this week's show. And remind everyone that, of course, we're on every week, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, with exciting and new guests. Next week we'll have Dennis Hill, Tiger Authority, and somewhat controversial, and we'll be talking to him next week on our program. And, of course, a big thank you to Wayne Larson over in Dayton, Ohio, who's manning the controls tonight, our technical producer. Of course, Melissa Hovey, she's always back there to watch the phones and monitor them tonight as well. And, of course, handling the chores of the Wild World News, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson.
We have been in a heat wave here in central Indiana in the western part of the state.
It's been pretty brutal.
Oh, it's been, I know folks that live in Florida who have been overseas, the servicemen who have paid their dues in Iraq and Afghanistan will say this is nothing, but I'm telling you right now, for this Hoosier, it's brutal. So they're saying cooler weather is around the corner. Well, we talk cooler, we're talking the 80s, and that would be quite a break, I'll tell you right now. So we're looking forward to that. Tonight's Wild World News, presented by Dr. Henry Day, is underwritten by Jet Kaiser Films. Jet Kaiser, he's the guy, if you have a documentary or a corporate film production that you want to put together, he's an artist, all HD. He'll travel around the world, and his website is jetkaiser.com. So be sure that you check him out and thank him for being the man behind our Wild World News. What have you got for us tonight, Doctor?
Well, before we get into the animal news, any new developments at the Batson Wildlife Preserve?
New developments? Well, the animals all look at me like I'm nuts when they're laying in the shade, and I'm trying to make sure they have enough water to drink and cool them down with, you know, the tigers, and do enjoy a sprinkle. Not all the tigers, though. A lot of people, you know, we see pictures of tigers in the wild, we see them in water, but it's about a 50-50 deal here. Half of the tigers will enjoy the water, or half of them don't like it at all. So, but that's a big job, just keeping everybody cool. And, of course, as always, our brand-new baby, well, she's a year and a half old, Olive Baboon, beats me up almost every day, so I always have that to look forward to.
Well, you didn't have any kids, so there you go.
Yes, this is the good Lord's way of paying me back.
Hey, I know that here locally the schools are starting up again. When will your animal lectures go back into?
Well, they usually start, of course, they have this mass extensive testing, you know, the ISTEP and whatever else they can come up with. So we'll be starting toward the end of September, 1st of October, and then we'll see about 200 schools. And, of course, if we do have any local listeners in the state of Indiana that are tuning in tonight, and if your youngster goes to school, wants to feature our program, we can go to my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and all the information is there about scheduling a program where we can bring our wild animals to educate and entertain these student audiences. So what have you got tonight, Doctor?
Well, let's start out with this. Here's some good news.
All right.
This weekend, the National Park Service will waive entry fees to 146 parks and other sites that normally charge up to $25 for admittance. Included are the big destination parks, you know, such as Yellowwood, as well as historic homes and historic parks and sites. And even some of the concessionaries are offering their own incentives, such as discounts on boat rentals, horseback riding, even gift shop purchases. And Priceline.com has also gotten into the game with offering related travel deals to these state parks.
Oh, is that the state parks or is that the national parks?
The national parks.
Oh, wow, that's tremendous. So you can get into Yellowstone or Rocky Mountain or Glacier for nothing this week. That's quite a deal, especially still during the
quite
season.
A deal.
Yeah.
So this is the weekend to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're also in the Perseid meteor showers. They peak tonight. So all of you stargazers, go out after midnight tonight or any time of the night, you can see the meteor showers. But it's a peak night. They'll vary for a couple of days. So if you are in the parks this weekend, you'll be able to see a few shooting stars. Now, tonight, they're predicting like possibly 100 stars an hour, 100 shooting stars an hour.
And this will be occurring all over the United States, I assume?
Yep.
Oh, wow. I'll be out after midnight.
The meteor showers are affiliated with a Swift-Tuttle comet that comes by this way every year. So get out there, lie on your back, and enjoy the stars.
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's head off to Spain. Jellyfish are wreaking havoc. A flotilla of small, virtually undetectable jellyfish have stung hundreds of people on the Spanish beaches this week. The blobs attacked three areas near the eastern city of Elche, along a stretch of beaches commonly known as the Casablanca. On Tuesday, 380 people were stung, compared with the usual four or five a day. Now, there were no signs of the jellyfish this last Wednesday, but due to the strong currents, they believe they swept all the jellyfish into the beaches. Then the water became calm, and so they hung around for a couple of days.
So you know what that means.
Yeah,
there's a lot of people getting peed on over in Spain.
Oh, yeah.
They say that's if you're, I guess it's true. I've never been stung by a jellyfish, so I don't know.
Well, when I lived in Tampa, the common remedy for a jellyfish sting was Adolph's meat tenderizer.
Oh, really?
The seasoning, yes. That's what we used in Tampa.
Well, I'll be.
That sting didn't bother me too much. I've been stung many times, but some people, I guess, it just really messes them up.
Well, I assume it's probably like an insect sting. For some people, are quite allergic to bee stings, so same deal probably.
All right. Well, here's some good news. A federal judge reinstated Endangered Species Act protection for wolves in Montana and Idaho, saying the government made a political decision in removing the protections from just two of the three states where the Rocky Mountain wolves roam. Now, the U.S. District Judge Donald Malloy said the entire Rocky Mountain wolf population either must be listed as an endangered species or removed from the list, but the protections can't be different for each state. So the decision puts a halt to wolf hunts in Montana and Idaho planned for this fall.
Well, good for them. And, of course, also there's recently been a campaign on Facebook. In fact, I got this from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife people about Idaho, about the slaughtering of wolves, and they were boycotting products such as an Idaho potato. Don't buy them because of the atrocities going on with the wolves in Idaho. So that's outstanding news.
I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, Titusville, Florida. A manatee caught in a fishing line was captured at the marina there and is being taken to Lowry Park Zoo in Tampa for treatment. Wildlife officials believe the 1,300-pound manatee is one of at least seven that has been entangled in this fishing line. So they've rescued the manatee and taken it there to Lowry Park. Now, I lived in Tampa and worked at Busch Gardens, and Lowry Park was pretty close to where I lived, and so I spent a lot of time there. Now, I was just there a few years ago, and I have to say that it's probably one of the best zoos in the United States. So if you have the opportunity to get there in Tampa, you must go to Lowry Park Zoo.
I'll remember that.
Okay, we're off to Billings, Montana. A state zoo is planning a contest to name two of the three grizzly cubs whose mother was euthanized last week for mauling three campers in the Yellowstone National Park. Now, we reported on that story, and they were going to decided that they were going to euthanize all the animals, but they decided to keep all three of the cubs. And the oldest, the largest cub is named Dolly, and they're going to try to come up with names for the other two. So we had a good ending to a bad story.
Well, that's right. And these will be kept in zoos, or will they be released later, does the article
They'll
say?
Be kept there. No, they'll have to be kept
okay.
there. Because
okay.
All right. Okay, Reno, Nevada. The state's 1,500 or so wild turkeys are getting a reprieve. The State Board of Wildlife Commission has called off the fall hunting season on the non-native birds, citing a decline in their numbers due to a combination of drought and predators. Statewide closure is the first since the 1980s. So the turkeys are going to make it through Thanksgiving this year.
Oh, good for the turkeys.
Topeka, Kansas.
Yes, sir.
A giraffe born at the Topeka Zoo with deformed rear legs was recovering after a procedure to help her survive. Veterinarian Joe Kamer replaced casts on Hope that have been she's been wearing since birth. They made some material attached to her legs, so a 3/4-inch plywood, extended heels, and the shoes included an artificial tendon that were glued to Hope's feet to help her walk. And it sounds kind of brutal, but it's actually a really good thing.
Yeah, it's
to make a little giraffe more mobile.
Right, and grow up to be a big giraffe. Will it have to wear these apparatus for the entire life, or does it say?
Yeah, she'll have to, as she grows, she'll have to have new devices made for her.
Okay. That's too bad.
Yeah, but she's still here, and we'll enjoy her.
That's right.
Okay, well, let's see. Now, here's a story that I normally don't like to tell stories like this, but this is the thing when you're in the state parks, anytime you're outside. Montana. Wildlife officials said 8 bighorn sheep rams were killed when lightning struck a ponderosa pine on the Wild Horse Island in Flathead Lake. Fish and Wildlife Parks Warden Captain Lee Anderson said the rams died in the last week, and they were found within like 15 foot of the tree.
Hmm. Wow, that's very odd. That's very rare.
It is very odd. Very unusual.
Yes. Too bad.
Owensboro, Kentucky. State wildlife officials said herds of wild hogs are spreading. A state survey in 1998 found wild hogs in only 2 counties in the southeastern part of the state. Now, wildlife biologist Chad Shord said that herds have been documented in 32 counties, and wildlife officials expect that they're probably in at least another dozen counties.
Well, that's great. That's outstanding, Dr. Day.
And it still goes on.
Yes, it
does. Okay. Now, our guest tonight will be really happy to hear this story, Mr. Pyle. Bristol, Rhode Island. Wildlife officials are baffled by the presence of a butterfly more common to the south that has taken up residence by the thousands. The Audubon Society said more than 3,200 Baltimore checker spots were located in the town. July Lewis, Audubon's volunteer coordinator, said the experts are trying to figure out why they congregated in this area.
Well, we'll have to ask Mr. Pyle when he comes on. He might have a theory on it.
We will, and he'll be on shortly here. Here's the last of the story tonight, something local. We'll end up with a local story.
Okay.
A fishing story.
Uh-oh.
Girls' catch spawns new record category. We're in Wabash, Indiana. Mm-hmm. A northern Indiana girl who caught a strange-looking fish in the Wabash River has ushered in a new fish category with her haul. After Lindsay Fleshwood, 13, landed a short-nosed gar in July, they discovered that the that Indiana has only one record category of the three species of the long-snouted cylindrical fish species found in the state. Basically,
yeah.
They're just saying gars. She entered a photo and other information about her 24.5-inch, 1.58-pound catch in the Department of Natural Resources Record Fish Program. State Fisheries Chief Bill James reviewed her entry and decided to add a state record category for short-nosed gar.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, good
that
for her.
That's pretty cool, isn't it?
Absolutely. What a way to finish the news tonight. Well, thank you, Dr. Day.
Dr.
Henry Day
welcome.
With the Wild World News, we'll remind everyone it's been underwritten by Jet Kaiser Films. Go to his website, jetkaiser.com, and find out all about the recent projects that he's been working on. I know he was in New York City, and he sent out an email that he just met Rupert G. from Hello Deli. So that's very, very, very exciting. So we'll hear more about that when he returns back home. We want to remind everyone also that Larry Batson's Wild World is underwritten by several people that keep us on the air, such as We Want You Cottages way up in Chautauqua Lake, New York. They've got a very exciting new website called iKids Fishing, where youngsters can submit, download their picture of that big whopper they just caught and compare it to young fishermen all across the country. That website is www.wewanchu.com. And, of course, if you're thinking about going fishing, man, the muskie, walleye, smallmouth, northern pike, it's hot up there. It's way up in western New York. And Peter, and Kathy Weimer, they'll be more than happy to be your host. They've got a fantastic resort. We thank We Want You Cottages. Also, McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful and scenic Estes Park, Colorado, right on the edge of Rocky Mountain National Park. Folks, it's absolutely spectacular. If you've never been to that part of the country, you owe it to yourself to at least go once. It is unbelievable. God's country. In your backyard, there on the grounds of McGregor Mountain Lodge, you may see bighorn sheep, elk. It's fantastic. And think about the fall or even the winter, because people will be surprised. Even in this mountainous country, they keep the roads cleared, and it's you have the place to yourself. So think about that. Their website is info@McGregorMountainLodge.com. Their number is 1-800-835-8439. And a big thank you to Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina. Lake Marion and Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes, they cover 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline. Known for world-class fishing, they hold 7 state records and 1 world record. Their website is www.santeecoopercountry.org, or call the girls to make your reservation. They'll line up your fishing guide, your motel, everything you need. That number is 1-800-227-8510. That's Santee Cooper Country down in beautiful, scenic, and pretty darn warm right now, South Carolina. Our guest tonight is, I'll tell you what, he's quite a gentleman. I had a chance to meet him a few weeks ago over in Shepherdstown, West Virginia at the big SC3 conference. I'll tell you what, it's quite an honor. He's a PhD from Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. He's assistant curator at Yale's Peabody Museum as a butterfly conservation consultant for Papua New Guinea. Northwest Land Steward for the Nature Conservancy, he received a 1997 Distinguished Service Award from the Society for Conservation Biology. He now lives in the rural community of Grays River up in Washington, the southwestern part of the state. Written several books. In fact, tonight we're going to talk about the one in particular because I know we have a lot of interest in it. I was most impressed by, to tell you the truth, as I was gazing through his biography, as he wrote the Audubon Society Field Guide to North American Butterflies, which Dr. Day says he has it in his massive library.
I couldn't live without it.
That's absolutely right. And it's quite an honor to have him on with us tonight. He has a very busy schedule, so this took a little bit of work to put this together. But Robert Michael Pyle from his home in Oregon, welcome, sir. It's nice to have you on.
Well, good evening, Larry. It's a pleasure to be with you and also with you, Dr. Day. Thank you for having
me
on the program.
So what about, he was talking about those butterflies. What do you know about that?
Well, it's very interesting. I've been pondering that since you said that. Now, Dr. Day, would you tell me again where that news report generated from? Do you have that handy?
Yeah.
He's got to look through his massive
Rhode Island, Bristol, Rhode Island.
Bristol, Rhode Island. That's interesting. The butterfly involved was, it's called the Baltimore Checker Spot. It's the state butterfly of the state of Maryland. It's not an endangered species, but it is one that's considered quite uncommon in a lot of places. In fact, in a recent butterfly adventure of mine that I'll hope to talk with Larry about a little bit later on, I finally got to see that butterfly after years and years and years of trying. So, you know, it's not that easy to find it. So all of a sudden for them to have thousands of them in Rhode Island, that is unusual, to be sure. I'll tell you what, though, that butterfly, first of all, we should say it's not one of those that migrates or emigrates in large numbers like the true migrant like the monarch or the immigrants like the painted lady butterflies that come in by the millions in certain years. It's not like that. It's a butterfly that is very much sedentary. It stays at home. And yet it belongs to a group of butterflies called the checker spots or the genus Euphydrius, which have been studied at great length by Professor Paul Ehrlich at Stanford University and his students and colleagues for many, many years. And one thing they've discovered about those checker spots is they have the capacity to boom and to bust. And so we commonly will have populations of them that crash due to certain circumstances, and the population just flickers out. They have extinctions of them, which isn't a problem if we have another nearby population to recolonize. With the Baltimore checker spot, we'll see these eruptive events, not usually that large, but over the history of American butterfly studies, we read about the Baltimores popping up here and popping up over there in fairly good numbers, and then just flickering out. My guess is that this particular habitat in Rhode Island probably had either a very small population, or else it received a wandering female that was gravid last year, found the conditions to be just right, and then the hot conditions you've had in the East this year in the Midwest, I bet they found that things were just exactly right for them, and they just boomed. They just popped. And so a large survivorship occurred, whereas most years the majority of the eggs and the larvae would be predated by something. This year they had a high survivorship, and you just had a lot more of them than are normally seen. That would be my guess, gentlemen.
Great. So this is a big deal in your world, I assume.
Yeah, it really is. It's not a butterfly that's in immigrants where you can, certain years you see vast numbers of them, but see thousands of Baltimores in one place. That is a big deal. You got to understand that this is a butterfly that some of the butterfly conservation people have instituted captive breeding programs for in some of the zoos in order to plant them out in suitable habitats. So people are working hard to develop small populations of 10 or 20 or 100 or 200 of these instead of have thousands in one place. That is a big deal. You're quite right.
I would think that the butterfly is much like the frogs or the amphibians of the world. They're kind of the barometer on how our environment is doing.
That's very perceptive of you, Larry. Butterflies are excellent environmental indicators. It's one of the reasons I got into butterfly conservation really over 40 years ago. As a young man, I decided that, you know, butterflies were fun. I was a kid who caught bugs like most kids, and I never gave up. But because of my early interest in butterflies and my interest in conservation that was inspired by my mother and certain teachers I had, the two kind of came together for me, and I realized that not very many people were looking at butterfly conservation. And so I started looking into that a long time ago. Had a chance to go to England and study it for a while with some people who were working on it in detail over there. And I found that that's exactly right. Butterflies are excellent environmental indicators. They're sensitive to changing conditions. They are specialists on certain caterpillar host plants because, remember, every butterfly is two different kinds of animals in its life. For the majority of its life, it depends on the type of butterfly. It depends on which stage they spend the winter in that is the majority of their life. But for a good deal of their life, they are a crawling, chewing, worm-like animal that we call a caterpillar, and then they pupate and they undergo this remarkable radical metamorphosis. And then they come out at the other part of their life as a totally different kind of animal. And at that time, they are flying, sucking, reproducing animals that we call butterflies. And so there's two different types of lifestyles have very different requirements. And because of that, we find that in order for a butterfly to prosper in a given place, as those Baltimores are prospering in Rhode Island, they have to have just the right set of conditions. And so when we see butterfly populations declining, we can say, you know, something about that place is not quite right. Something is changing. It might be something that would affect the birds and the amphibians. It might be something that might affect ourselves. We better pay attention to the fluctuating populations of butterflies.
Well, I can see your fascination. Of course, when you brought that up, that we basically, you're right, we have two changing animals, from a worm-like caterpillar to a magnificent butterfly, that this is probably the only group of animals, insects, whatever, that to go through this type of change in their life.
Well, if you look at insects as a whole, and of course, when you're looking at insects, you're looking at easily a fifth of life on Earth, and very possibly more than that. Beetles themselves are the largest group of animals on the Earth, and the weevils are the biggest group of beetles. So there are lots and lots and lots of these things out there, a great deal of species diversity. But when you look at insects, the entire order of insects, we find that there are two different lifestyles that insects break down into. We call one of those styles the hemimetabolous insects, or the ones that we could call a partial metamorphosis. Now, they do change pretty radically, but they undergo a metamorphosis whereby the young stages, that we tend to call nymphs, resemble the adult more and more progressively. But they're sort of like an undeveloped version of the adult. And so examples of those insects would include the dragonflies and damselflies, the true bugs, the grasshoppers, and so on. But then we have the more highly evolved butterflies, such as the butterflies and moths, the flies, and the bees and wasps and ants. And those butterflies, and the beetles, and those butterflies undergo what we call them holometabolous, and that means that they undergo a truly profound or radical metamorphosis. And all of those insects change from an egg into the caterpillar, which is called grubs for beetles or maggots for flies, and from that into a pupa, which we call a chrysalis in a butterfly and a cocoon in a moth, and from that into the adult. So there are really quite a few species that undergo that. But butterflies being the most spectacular to our eyes, probably, and among the most beautiful to our sense of beauty, and among the most conspicuous. They're the ones that we really think of as the grand metamorphosers. And also, Larry, it's because of their conspicuousness and their beauty that, of course, that's another reason they make great indicators, because we tend to notice them much more than we notice most groups of insects.
Probably there are more undiscovered species of insects than any other part of the animal kingdom. Would you say that would be true?
I think that's absolutely true. There's a man at the Smithsonian by the name of Terry Irwin who began to come out with some estimates a few years back in which he suggested that, the published literature suggests there might be something like a million species of animals, the majority of which would be invertebrates, the majority of those would be insects, with maybe 150,000 species of moths described and maybe 20,000 species of butterflies. And he thought that those numbers are far too low. They might be about right for butterflies, which have had a lot of investigation. But when you start looking at the canopies of the rainforest, you find that the diversity in given groups is much higher than was expected. And it may well be that there are 30 million species of insects, with the majority of them not having been named or discovered yet. And, of course, the great concern and fear and tragedy might be that many of these species might become extinct before we ever have a chance to come to terms with them or even give them a name.
In your worldwide travels, what would you say, in your eyes, in your perspective, is the most amazing part of the world as far as the study of butterflies and other insects?
I was lucky to go to that place. Now, I have to say that I've never been in South America, which is a huge and glaring gap in my experience. I've been to every other continent except Antarctica. I've done butterfly work in many parts of the world, and not just butterflies, birding, various other things too. I've spent time in Central Asia. I've spent time in the South Seas. I've spent time in Latin America, certainly in Central America, in the high Arctic, and in lots of other places. Most every state, most countries in Europe, and so on and so forth. South America might provide an even more profound experience than what I've experienced so far. I must keep that possibility open. But I will say that as a young man, I had the opportunity to work for the government of Papua New Guinea, which was a newly independent country. It was composed of the Dutch colony of Dutch New Guinea and the, the Dutch half of New Guinea became West Irian, which is part of Indonesia. The east half of the island of New Guinea was composed of the German colony known as Nueva Guinea, the northern part, and the southern part, which was known as Papua, which was a British colony. They came under Australian protectorship, and then they became independent in 1976. In 1977, I got to go there and work for the Wildlife Division to come up with a butterfly conservation plan for their superb butterfly fauna, particularly the giant birdwing butterflies, the genus Ornithoptera, the biggest of which, the Queen Alexandra's birdwings, are as big as a dinner plate. They can exceed a foot in wingspan. There are a dozen species of them, and they're quite spectacular. The males are a little bit smaller, 6 to 9 inches, but spectacular colors of chartreuse and extraordinary blues and greens and so on. The females are not so flashy in color. They're black and white for the most part, but they're the biggest of all. And they're specialists on various kinds of Aristolochia vines. And they were also rare. They have a longer life and a smaller brood size than most invertebrates. They really, Larry, if you study their biology, you'd find it much more like the vertebrates on which you're a great expert in terms of their lifestyle. And consequently, they don't reproduce as rapidly as other insects. And being so spectacular and so big, they were subject to a lot of commercial collecting. Now, most insects, it would be very difficult to over-collect because they are insects, you know. You can't conceive of controlling flies or mosquitoes with the fly swatter any more than you could damage most butterflies with the butterfly net. Butterfly nets are the greatest and cheapest environmental education tool we ever had, and it's very hard to hurt a butterfly population with a butterfly net. But these bird wings were different because they were so valuable and so narrowly confined ecologically, and they reproduced so slowly that they could be over-collected. And so the plan was to bring a person in, and I was lucky to be that person, to come up with a plan for farming the commoner bird wings in the villages to provide three things really, Larry. The first thing was a social reform, because the black market was taking the value of those butterflies and giving it to expatriate profiteers instead of the local people. The second thing was, of course, and this was the most important, was to protect the population by preventing over-collecting. And then the third thing was to come up with a reform that would provide a rationale for protecting the forest. The bush was under threat from Japanese timber royalties and from British oil palm plantations. And if the people had a reason to resist those, they would, so they could maintain their subsistence economy. So when we went in and showed them how they could farm commoner bird wings and other butterflies in order to sell them on the international market through a government agency, with all the profit going to the village, that took off in a big way, and it's provided a protected mechanism for a lot of those forests. No longer are the bird wings in the black market. The most rare species are fully protected, and the common ones are bred. And the great thing is that a lot of other countries have emulated this now, and most of the breeding stock from the butterfly farms is provided to the butterfly houses around the world for livestock. You've seen these places, Larry. I think Indianapolis has a great one. So does Omaha, where you can go in and you can see these live butterflies in the artificial rainforests, and people can gain a close appreciation of butterflies close up, knowing that the profit goes to the local villagers to protect their native rainforest.
Well, our guest tonight is Robert Michael Pyle, a naturalist extraordinaire. We're going to take a break here, and when we return, we're going to be talking to Robert about the book that he wrote in 1995, I believe. It's called Where Bigfoot Walks, Crossing the Dark Divide. This is Larry Batson. We'll be back in just a few moments, and you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
There are some visitors you'd just rather not see. Like your obnoxious brother-in-law, Lily.
Hey, everybody, we're here. Good to see you. When do we eat?
But then there are some visitors you just can't get enough of. To make your farm or ranch a more attractive place for the visitors you actually want to see, contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office. They can help you build the habitat wildlife loves. But as for Louie, try disconnecting the doorbell. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
Hi, this is Pat Green. The blood supply is at critically low levels, and you can help. Call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. That's 1-800-GIVE-LIFE to schedule your appointment to donate blood. Your donation is critical because every 2 seconds someone in America needs blood. That's accident victims, surgical candidates, and cancer patients, just to name a few. Please donate blood and encourage your friends, family, and neighbors to give too. Please call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to make your appointment. Thank you.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, 1 second I'm having a smoke taken into view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. This is Larry Batson. You're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio here every Thursday night live at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. But go to our archives and you can listen to shows present and past. And we've got many, many, many that I know you'll, if you haven't had the opportunity to check out, you'll want to. We've had some very spectacular guests. Tonight is no exception. We want to remind everyone as well, this program is underwritten by several folks, such as We Want You Cottages way up Chautauqua Lake, New York, and they've got a very exciting new website called iKids Fishing, where youngsters can download their picture of that big whopper they just caught. Go to the website, www.wewantyou.com, and also if you're planning a vacation, a fishing trip, it's pretty good fishing. They're catching the muskies right now up there in western New York. Also, a big thank you to McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, not too far from where Robert Michael Pyle grew up in the Rocky Mountains, right on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. Info at McGregorMountainLodge.com or make your reservation at 1-800-835-8439. And in the next few weeks, Michael Hodges will be joining us with McGregor Mountain Lodge. He's quite the mountaineer, and we're going to be talking about some of his adventures he's been on lately. And also, Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina, Lake Marion, Lake Moultrie. Man, if you've never gone fishing in that part of the country, I had the opportunity a couple years ago. It was absolutely spectacular. I mean, the fishing is extraordinary. The catfish, you might hook anyone from 20 to 100 pounds. You have no idea. And their website is www.santeecoopercountry.org or use their 800 number, 1-800-227-8510. And also be sure to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. It tells all about our wildlife education work that we do, also our wild animal rescues, and also our many books that we have for sale, such as our brand new children's book, Alphabet Swamp. And you can order that through our website. We'll send you a signed copy. Or if you'd like to contribute, you can do that as well to our wildlife rescue work. It is filled with pictures of our animals from past and present. Tonight our guest is Robert Michael Pyle. I had a chance to meet Mr. Pyle a few weeks ago at the SC3 conference in beautiful and scenic Shepherdstown, West Virginia, at the very massive facility called the National Conservation Training Center. That place is something else, isn't it, Robert?
You know, Larry, it really is. I've had several chances to stay there. I love the place. They call it the Birdhouse because Senator Byrd lobbied for having it built in his district. It was a piece of a beautiful piece of pork, you could say, a well-done one that Senator Byrd brought back to his district. Many, many conservation organizations and agencies have done their training there, and I think it's an excellent expenditure of public money. I have to say, though, that I will never again, even though I've had good times there, I have stayed in the lodges named for Rachel Carson and Aldo Leopold, and I have birdwatched there with the poet laureate named Robert Haas. But I will never forget one of my favorite times there, which was to watch Larry Batson speaking about Bigfoot to the kids at the campfire at the Student Climate and Conservation Congress a couple of months ago. And Larry, I have never seen a bunch of young people who are well attuned to the modern world and probably completely jaded by modern entertainment. They were absolutely dumbfounded and spellbound by your storytelling around that campfire.
Oh, well, gosh, I mean, if it was television, I'd be blushing. Man, what great words from such a person I respect so much. It was.
Well, it's absolutely true. You're a great storyteller. And you know, while I'm dishing out the compliments here, I want to give another word for your underwriter, because I've been to that McGregor Ranch, that McGregor Lodge, and that's a beautiful and wonderful place outside of Estes Park. I like it a lot. It's a fine place, and I recommend your visitors go there. I have had the experience in recent years to be there, but also to be at another lodge just down the road that I'm sure is good friends of theirs, a place called Meeker Park Lodge. It's an old 1930s log mountain lodge where I have worked for quite a few years, off and on different drafts of a novel I've been working on, a novel called Magdalena Mountain. And in many ways, that novel is sort of the linkage for me between Butterflies and Bigfoot, because it's a butterfly story, but it's a butterfly story that involves a mystery.
Well, you know, I was talking with them, Michael Hodges, who's the proprietor of McGregor Lodge, and he's quite the mountaineer. In fact, he's nuts. I mean, he doesn't just walk up the mountain. He runs up the mountain.
Oh, like Enos Mills. He had a neighbor years back called Enos Mills at the Enos Mills Lodge, the Long's Peak Lodge, a famous old lodge in those territories, and he did the same thing. There must be a tradition of running up those mountains.
Oh, well, you know, I had the wife and I, the first time that she'd ever been west of the Mississippi was on our honeymoon, and we went to Estes Park and stayed at McGregor Mountain Lodge.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah, and I used to go out there when I was just a little tyke. That's where we went every year for 2 weeks.
Oh,
in fact, our neighbors would go, "Why do you always go to this?" I'd say, "You don't understand. because that place is like church. It is godlike. I mean, when you walk there and you breathe the air and you smell the pines and you look at those mountains, it is like...
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, not unless you've seen it, you can't describe it. I mean...
Well, I agree, and it smells so good, and the wildflowers and butterflies. And of course, over there at McGregor, you're on the side of this park where you're up near the three owls. You remember those big pink...
Yeah, the twin owls.
They're called
Twin owls.
Yeah.
Owls, right.
Wonderful.
Behind the Stanley Motel, the inspiration for Stephen, the horror writer. I'm having a fade.
Yeah.
King.
The Shining.
Yeah, Stephen King. The Shining. Yeah. But, I was talking.
I've got a better remembrance of that. I've got a better remembrance of that, though. I saw the entire Vivaldi Four Seasons played by a wonderful violinist at the Stanley Motel. So I mean, it's probably a better memory than Jack Nicholson freaking out.
the place is just amazing. And in fact, my favorite experiences was going with a park ranger and going on the hike up to Flat Top Mountain and Alice Peak.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And of course, and up there, and you know, it's kind of wild when you go up to the top of Hallett's. And you go down the mountain and you're down in the Bear Lake parking lot and you look up and think, wow, I was up there. It seems so far away.
Yeah. And then you want to be back up there after you get down that parking lot. You want to be back up there.
Oh, it's just an extraordinary part of the world. But one of the conversations that I had I'd gone to the NASA Conservation Training Center a year before that and given a Sasquatch program in the auditorium. For just everybody.
Yeah.
And then they invited me to come back for the student conference. And one of the things that Stephen Chase had told me, he says, hey, we're having Robert Pyle in, and he wants to talk to you because you two share the same interests. So I said, really? And I thought, wow, that's... And then I discovered that you'd written this book, I Feel So Stupid Naive, and it was called Where Bigfoot Walks, Crossing the Dark Divide.
Well, there's a lot of things out there to read, Larry.
Oh, there is. But I've always thought that I'd read everything, but I had not. So I felt very ignorant at the time, and it was such a pleasure to meet you. And when we sat down and talked about it for the first time, it's like when two people on this subject get together, they can't tell enough.
That's right.
So what inspired you to write this book? What was all involved with it?
You kind of ran through some of my background there. I've been involved in a lot of aspects of natural history. Mm-hmm. I had the good fortune to have some excellent mentors in natural history. And I also had a great teacher of Northwest Indian art and culture, Bill Holm at the University of Washington in the late 60s, early 70s. And he told us that every single Native American, Bella Bellas, Bella Coolas, Tsimsheans, Nootkas, Haidas, Kwakoodles, and so on, that he knew everyone who still lived out in the meadows and the bays and the woods and the inlets rather than in the city still had a very literal belief that Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Tsleil-Waututh, Oma, Tsleil-Waututh lived among them. Not as Tsimshian, the sea seal, the sea serpent, or thunderbird, or some mythic creature, but like skunk, or weasel, or bear, or mink, a real, actual flesh and blood animal. When he said that, I was quite intrigued. I began to looking into Bigfoot quite some little bit, and I had an experience in 1970 that I'll share with you in a moment. But in 75, I ran into Peter Byrne, one of the great old Bigfoot researchers, whom I'm going to see in a couple of weeks at a Bigfoot gathering in Carson, Washington. And I brought him back to give a seminar at Yale at the forestry school. And I tell you, Larry, by the end of that seminar, he had those eminent Yale anthropologists and primatologists scratching their heads and maybe their ribs thinking, my goodness, maybe there's something to this. And I saw the opening of minds that day, and I said, that's impressive. So that's when I began looking into it in depth.
That was almost my same experience. I was...
Is that right?
Oh, yes. In fact, very quickly, and I've discussed this before, Jim Fowler, the old co-host of Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, they were doing a television program called Spirit of Adventure, and they'd gone to Russia to film a documentary on the Russian brown bear. And I discussed this during my program in Shepherdstown. But all the Russian guides wanted to talk about was Bigfoot, because they had seen something and found evidence of something which was very similar to what they had read about that occurred in the United States.
Sure, the Delmas or the Almasti, one of those?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So what was your first occurrence, or you were getting ready to...
Shall I read you a couple of paragraphs from the book?
Please. That, please do.
You do that?
Yeah.
This is from the book Where Bigfoot Walks, Crossing the Dark Divide, published by Houghton Mifflin Company. Now it's Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is from the first chapter called Not Looking for Bigfoot. It was Halloween night of 1970. I was 23 years old, camping near Mount St. Helens. I couldn't sleep, and then the cries began. From the north southwest, up toward the Plains of Abraham, they boiled out of the night like bats from a deep and silent cave, each one an invisible note on the staff of the black sky. At first the calls resembled shrill barks, but not canine in the least, and then they accelerated in tempo, grew in volume, and rose in pitch until they sounded more like whistles. Now, I'd been studying ornithology and mammalogy with Professor Frank Richardson, a great naturalist, and we'd gone over the known vocabularies of Washington's birds and mammals. I'd heard many in the field and had listened to recordings of most of the others. I ran again through the species that might have produced that tortured concert. Elk, coyote, red fox, bobcat, puma, the winter owls. The calls I was hearing were not in the repertory of any of these, as far as I knew. My back was crawling, as well as yowling itself from the toboggan accident a week before, so I lay still and listened. The sound of the chorus changed again to suggest the crying of babies. The snowmobilers had long since left. There was no one up there. Cries persisted for many minutes, subsided, resumed, and then played on into the pre-dawn. They might have been a dream. They were so strange and unworldly, or rather, deeply visceral, but different from anything I knew in the world. Yet this was no dream, nor was it the wine, little and long gone. Joanne never woke up that night until the morning. Finally, I dropped off to sleep, and when I awoke, it was dawn, and the world was silent. I listened, crawled deep into my down cocoon, and slept again. The next thing I knew, weird cries were in my ear again, very close. A gray jay was perched on my shoulder, calling for breakfast. So, Larry, I heard those calls up on the site of Mount St. Helens in 1970, 10 years before the eruption. And 20 years later, when I was on my expedition across the Dark Divide under a, of all things, surprisingly enough, a Guggenheim Fellowship to study Bigfoot for a year, I heard those sounds again on the other slope, the other side of Mount St. Helens, what was left of Mount St. Helens after the eruption, over to a place called Elk Pass. And this was in the autumn. And I heard the sounds boiling up again out of the night. I heard them just as I'd heard them before. It was raining. And then all of a sudden, when I was about to get out and look for them with my flashlight, bam, something struck the top of my car. And at that point, the autonomic nervous system set in, and smooth muscles, you know, you don't have a choice. And I didn't pee my pants, but I did jam on the... accelerator, and I think if an old Honda can burn rubber on a wet mountain road, it hit and I tore out of there. But when I got back, there was nothing to be seen. Of course, I cursed myself for leaving. There was nothing to be afraid of. But when I came back, just 3 days later in the bright sunshine, there were 12 tracks, 12 good tracks right in the average size of the database of Bigfoot prints that's been kept by Peter Byrne and others, John Green and others. And that hooked me. I've been a Bigfoot aficionado ever since.
It's almost like it's an obsession.
It's close to an obsession. For some people, it truly becomes obsession. I feel that I've avoided that. I wanted, in writing this book, not to be obsessed, not to be a true believer or a true disbeliever. Larry, I'm a biologist by training. I'm steeped in the scientific method. I perform it with butterfly research. And I have not seen the animal, and I cannot tell you that it exists. I'm not an advocate for its existence. What I am an advocate for is having an open mind. You've told the stories, you've heard the stories, you've had experiences. When there is a body of evidence, even if it's anecdotal evidence, as large as we have, it behooves us to keep an open mind and not to dismiss it out of hand. And so we can think back to John Napier, the head of the Smithsonian primate program, who said, when it finally comes down to it, he preferred the ridiculous proposition that Bigfoot existed over the impossible proposition that all the tracks, all the sightings, all the sounds that people have reported were simply a hoax.
Bob Jackson, the Yellowstone Ranger who spent 25 years in the thoroughfare district of the most remote area of Yellowstone Park, he described those calls as the sound of 100 elk going to their death.
Oh, you told me that at the campfire. That was very, very striking. Larry, just 2 weeks ago, I was living in a small mountain cabin in northeastern Oregon without electricity for a couple of weeks on a writing retreat, and I heard 150 elk coming into the meadow next to me. They were not going to their death, happily, but
yeah,
they were going into rut. And I tell you, the sounds of 100 elk going into rut, that was really something right there, so I can even imagine. But, you know, the sounds of elk, they're powerful, they're impressive, but they're a different quality in general from this whole body of sounds that people report as Bigfoot tracks. I gave a reading for my book at Elliott Bay Bookstore in Seattle, and afterwards a group of Quileute Indians were there, and they presented a tape that they wanted people to hear, so they treat the subject with respect. And those sounds were the same I heard up on the Dark Divide and prior to that up on Mount St. Helens.
They similar to the sounds that I played around the campfire in Shepherdstown?
They were. That was part of the repertory. I've had a couple of different occasions now, three actually, where I've had the auditory experiences, and I've heard a fair range, I think, of their repertory. But absolutely, the sounds that you played that night gave me shivers at the campfire, not because I'm afraid of it, because we have very few reports of anything violent, but because it gives you a recognition, and this is the great gift of Bigfoot, Larry, for a biologist, for a poet, I'm a poet as well, for any of us who care about the world around us, the great wildlife world that your show is dedicated to. It gives us the sense that there's more than we know, that there's something beyond the campfire, that we have not got all the answers yet, and yet the answers might be approachable if we're good enough naturalists. And by that I mean if we go outside with our minds open, our eyes open, and our hearts open, we might receive extraordinary gifts of knowledge. It's a sad thing when I see fellow scientists close their minds to that and say it cannot be, or other kinds of skeptics. And it's good to be skeptical.
Well, it's a
but
subject.
But we have to remember that there are things that we might not know yet.
As John Green once said, the more you look into it, the more questions you have.
That's exactly right. And I want to tell you that I spent the year of 2008 traveling the entire country looking for as many butterflies as I can for a new book I've got coming out in 2 weeks' time called Mariposa Road, The First Butterfly Big Year. And believe me, Larry, if I didn't learn a lot of things that I never knew before that, then I'd be telling a lie. So there are some remarkable things in the world about butterflies that are at least as weird as anything that might possibly come out of the Bigfoot lore.
Absolutely, absolutely. I encourage everyone, if Robert Michael Pyle is in your area, to do a reading or a book signing, please attend, because he's truly, as we could sell tonight in the last hour, we've been just talking with him. He's truly very special, fascinating, and gosh, I mean, it seems like it's our race by. I would like to, Bob, invite you back again in the future if we can find time in your Very, very busy schedule. This has been absolutely wonderful.
I'd love to come again. Thank you, Larry. And I am going to be doing quite a book tour this fall for the new book, and I'll send you the schedule for your website.
Oh, please do, and I'll make sure that all of our listeners are aware of that, and I'm sure that they'll be attending and have many more questions to ask you. We want to remind everyone.
Right. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's been our pleasure, absolutely our pleasure, and we want to thank everyone for listening. And also, you can go into our archives and listen to this program over and over that you might have to, because there was so much information tonight that it was absolutely unbelievable. And we thank Robert Michael Pyle for being a part of our show. Next week, Dennis Hill will be here as we talk Tigers, and somewhat of a controversial character. We'll talk about that a little bit. He's behind a documentary for the Animal Planet, Tiger Next Door. And coming up in future weeks, we've got some amazing guests, so be sure that you tune in. This is Larry Batson. You've been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World Around the World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.